Off the Ball Daily.
A home for your favourite podcasts from Off the Ball.
Callum Walsh has come out and publicly said he doesn't want 50 grand, he doesn't want 100 grand, whatever that might be, as the bonus. I don't know this, he wants 2 Highland cows for his growing collection.
Wow.
Burgeoning farmer there, Callum Walsh.
Nice. Subscribe to the Off the Ball Daily podcast feed right now.
The Sunday Paper Review on Off the Ball.
Only one place to start, Philip. Kate O'Connor, World Championship silver medalist, just an incredible run over the year, and then to finish in the last few days with 5 personal bests and 7 events. And Cathal Dennehy, he's done some great work over there in Tokyo.
Yeah, and I think in Kate's own words, just insane is how she described it. So I can only imagine, to be good at one thing, like we're going to look at Ryder Cup and Rory McIlroy and various athletes, but to be good at one thing is hard enough. To be across the disciplines like her is just incredible. So I think Cathal's piece was interesting. He talked about interviewing her 6 years previously, wasn't it, when she won heptathlon silver at the European Under-20s. So I think even back then, I saw a tweet from last night that he'd marked her out and said, look, this is going to be a star as well. So he knows stuff. But what she's achieved is just incredible. And what I love about the coverage of the World Championships, the athletes, they're so good at post-race, they're so expressive, they're so open, and we're so used to guarded, kind of cliched, stilted interviews, whereas I know David Gillick's seems to be a very empathetic interviewer, and again, Cathal is interviewed after, and it's just wonderful, colourful quotes about her own journey. So, no, and just a little detail, she kind of even... the photograph with the flag that when she picked up the Irish flag to celebrate, it was the wrong way around, so she had to do a bit of...
It was Ivory Coast, was it?
Yeah, Ivory Coast. And again, there's another piece we'll get to what Ger Siggins talks about when Sonia, like the list of Ireland medal winners, like she's in such esteemed company now, but even Sonia, there was a fuss, which I'd forgotten about back in 95 when she won gold, wasn't it? And again, about not carrying the flag around the track and all. So it's amazing how all the years on, we're still into identity and all, everything that goes with it. But no, her story is just incredible, really. So
yeah, so it was Sonia O'Sullivan, Eamon Coughlin was the first, Gillian O'Sullivan, Oliver Loughnane, Rob Heffernan, and now Kate O'Connor. What have you made of this from a sports perspective as an athlete yourself, a former athlete, Kate, her progression to silver medal?
Oh, it's phenomenal. Like, it's what dreams, I think, are made of. Anyone who, you know, has ever competed at any level, and, you know, it's just unbelievable to see someone. I think maybe that's why we can all have such a visceral response to success stories like this. Like, I, you know, wouldn't know everything and about Kate O'Connor, you know, bar probably the you know, the of recent times, but you can understand to a degree everything that's gone into that, to be that successful, to come out on the biggest platform and deliver exceptionally well in that you're hitting 5 PBs out of 7 events that you're doing. Like that's what I think anyone who's involved in sport, you dream of those days, whether it's going out and winning an All-Ireland final, whatever it might be for you. To see that come to fruition for someone, you know, there's just been an incredible amount of work put into that. She hasn't just done it with a bit of luck in it.
But the family connection as well. I think it's, exactly. Her father is Martin coaching. So again, Cathal mentions, and the backstory with a lot of athletes, interesting with representation, that was it summer of 2022, O'Connor did enjoy a day in the sun. The newly born athlete won Commonwealth Games silver for Northern Ireland in Birmingham. And prior to the pandemic, she'd enrolled at Sheffield Hallam University and trained with some of Britain's best. But then it wasn't long before she relocated home, her dad building their own high performance circle. Like, how many sports can you say, oh, like, my dad decided to build a high performance circle and we've ended up with, you know, making history in Tokyo. So it's a kind of incredible backstory there, and a family Irish backstory as well.
So you have the 100-meter hurdles, the high jump, the shot push, the 200 meters, the long jump, the javelin throw, and the 800 meters. So,
yeah, no messing. Like, there, in terms of the demand that would have been placed on her body. And again, as Philip alluded to, it's, you know, mastering so many skills. Like, you know, most of us try and excel in one sport and stay in our lane in that respect.
No, you've done a few though, haven't you?
But even at that, I've a clear role within a team. I'm not there to kick points and score goals. I'm there to, you know, in my when I was playing at that level, you know, in football anyway, I was maybe tracking a player, and my work rate was what was needed of the team. So that's one skill in and amongst how many. So for Kate to come out and be performing at that elite level across seven disciplines, to have, and even I think as an athlete, like, and I remember working as part of a backroom team actually, and a sports psychologist at the time was saying about ANTS, and there it was an acronym for any negative thoughts, because that's something that can be part of progress or part and parcel of going out and competing at a level. And for me, that resonated so much, because there's so many times where you put the donkey work in, but that doubt can slide in. And and some of the pieces today and the athletes, like, you know, Kate mentioned herself, you know, where she, you know, doubted here and there, or had, you know, that feeling of maybe uncertainty, but her support network around her was so important. I think for her to be able to push that normal response to a side time and time again and turn up
well,
and deliver.
After crocking her knee, didn't she? Like, throwing a javelin. So there was a kind of, there was a mythic element to what she was doing in terms of, here's an athlete across the discipline, and then you've crocked your knee heading into, what was it, two of the last?
The last two, yeah. Last with two. The javelin, and there was no issue, but the 800 metres was a worry.
Yeah, yeah. But she was and in the set position. A personal best in the 800 metres while running with, you know, one leg nearly at a time. So just it added to the level. And again, I think tied into the Keane McPhillips was obviously another huge story, and Mark Gallagher writes about that, the TV week. So there's something, he was saying there's something wonderful. Normally, he said daytime TV could be kind of watching The Chase or Tipping Point, but the World Athletics, just with the timings, he said it was just a wonderful way to while away an afternoon. And I think anybody, if you started watching, if you turned it on during the week, you just got lost in, it was Mondo and the high jump and all the different things that were going on. But McPhillips, obviously, it's a huge positive success story this week for Irish athletics.
Well, this was the discipline of David Rudisha, wasn't it? The 800 metres. You're thinking about what Steve Yvette and Seb Coe, like an Irish athlete in an 800 metres final at the Worlds, has never happened before, men or women. And for him to finish, to not only break the record that Mark English had set in the semi-final, to break his own record then in the final, and finish like a train and just miss out and finish fourth. And there's obviously heartbreak around that because you didn't medal. But then you're, what, 23 years of age, and you're thinking about what's the future hold. I think when I was analysing the World Championships, Rashid Adeleke is not there. Kieran McGeehan's not there. What's the narrative around this? And the narrative now has that become that athletics is in a really good place in the nation. Mary O'Connor in the Sunday Independent, you know, I suppose, talking about the importance of sport and for well-being and for, you know, tackling obesity and actually improving the health service and pushing for more funds for that. But athletics is having its sweet spot after Paris last year and after the performances of Kate O'Connor and Keane McPhillips. And it's just, there's a wholesomeness to it or something I've kind of found. It was the front story, the top story in RT television last night in the 9 o'clock news was Kate O'Connor winning silver. It wasn't something in America or the presidency or something, because it's one of those things we saw with the relay runners last year and the performances of our Olympians that people can kind of, I think, can connect. There's not that closed, remote nature of you're a global star is the kind of person you see in the street next week.
Exactly. And even when, you know, Keane McPhillips was talking about, you know, how even with college and whatnot and the impact that that had on his career. And I suppose it's part and parcel why he's maybe, it feels like he's just all of a sudden catapulted into our view now, even though obviously a lot of donkey work has been done over the years. But it's just, they're just normal people, like, you know, and I think that makes it exciting because, you know, it shows that actually, you know, what's to come.
But I think you probably forget how big athletics is in this country and how many people, it just happened to be sister-in-law was running in half marathon, Athletics Club run a half marathon in Ferry House Racecourse last weekend. And there were literally now thousands of people. We just went up for the end. Thousands of people running it. It was a bigger crowd that you'd nearly see on the Monday Bank Holiday for the Grand National. So there's this kind of, and that was, they run that yearly. there was just, there's this kind of obviously huge subculture of people running athletics that, again, because it's an individual pursuit, you don't really see. So I do think there's, like Kate was saying, there's people can really identify with the people maybe and the discipline, whether they're running casually or not. I think, again, that it really seems to strike a chord, the athletics side of things.
I think it's important to strike while the iron is hot. You wouldn't know if Rashid Adeleke will ever medal at a World Championships. You hope that she will, and the evidence in the last few years suggests that she will in her career, but there's no guarantee. I think the one thing is that injuries, being injury-free and being in form is really important. Like Kate O'Connor had that, the European indoors performance, the World Silver indoors, the World University Games gold, and it was all coming to this point now, late in the year, where she was able to peak and get silver. And then that's a big positive for Los Angeles in 2028. Just from a nutrition perspective, Kate, because you know, you work in this field of health and performance nutrition. Would you imagine what she's going to plan she's on for, as an individual athlete? Would you have a sense of what she's on?
Well, I suppose like a key thing at this point, obviously, is like recovery is going to be so, so important. So, like, I mean, everything is dialed and would need to be dialed in to a T. There's no kind of second guessing. So, you know, injuries, as you mentioned, like stress factors were something that was that kind of was knocking on the door for Kate. So a big thing there is, from a fueling standpoint, making sure that, you know, energy needs are being met consistently, that, you know, I suppose from a nutrient timing standpoint, that anywhere we can get margins, we're looking to get them so that players can maximise the hours that they have between sessions. She's obviously a multi-event athlete, so she needs to turn up, you know, a few times in the one day and perform. So you're just trying to make sure that all your T's are crossed, your I's are dotted on that front to capitalise and then to bounce back then from those big events. And I think there needs to be a really good understanding, you know, from a dietary standpoint, but also like the physical demand there. And her team would be working hand in hand to make sure that each one is complementing one another, and that we, I suppose, are making this as bespoke to Kate as is possible, so that she is bouncing back, that she's ready to rock, and that she's confident when it comes to her event day, that she knows what she's doing inside and out, and she has confidence in that. That's one way to help put the focus then on the task at hand. So that her mind isn't being brought elsewhere. There's no maybe doubts creeping in that don't need to be there.
So the plans for nutrition for team sports, for different types of sports, are they different?
They are, depending on the event. I mean, and that's why I think that can make what Kate's doing, you know, challenging to a degree, because, you know, there's different considerations for each of those events. But it's the same for each sport. Like, there might be themes, so say rugby and football and the likes, they would have common threads dotted throughout. But then again, you plonk these athletes into different events, so say a tournament's going to look different to, you know, your weekly match. So it's bringing in that context. And also then she's away in a different country. It's understanding what's available.
Time zones, yeah.
Time zones. And from a rest and recovery standpoint, like what, you know, from my perspective with athletes that are traveling abroad, you know, it's looking at, okay, well, what is going to be available to me? What are my staples that I can actually take with me? You know, how can I alleviate any cause of stress that's already a pressured environment? And for a lot of athletes, it's a very privileged place to be. That's what we do dream of, even if sometimes we feel like, oh God. But that's what the work is done for. So anywhere that we can mitigate, so whether that's, you know, any supplements that you might be taking to help, any pre-training rituals that you might have in and around food, like you'd be seeing what can go in the suitcase, and you'd be bringing that along with you, just because the last thing you want to do is rock up at a big event and go, I'm going to try. You don't want to introduce anything new. And you've got a little time to adjust. As you said, you've got, you know, time zones and everything to factor in as well. There's a lot of moving parts. So the last thing we want to do is throw something else that could otherwise be controlled.
We have quite a lot of things to talk about on the pay-per-view, I suppose. And we'll get back to that because there's an interesting piece about the very sad passing of Ricky Hatton and just a Tommy Conlon's piece, and there's kind of a thread there. But the Ryder Cup starts next Friday, and it's in New York between Europe and the United States. So golf, I think for 3 days a year, if you're into team golf, it's probably the only thing that matters. And then a lot of us tend to forget about it. But these are always the moments when you get good writing in advance of it. And Philip Eamon Darcy in 1987 was a huge part of the Europeans' first ever win in America in Ohio on Jack Nicklaus's course, a Wicklow golfer. And David Kelly in the Sunday Independent done a nice profile on Eamon.
And it's actually, Dave, there's a lovely piece here with Eamon, and it includes it actually a load of brilliant detail, which I wouldn't have known about, certainly. I think he talked at the start. He says he describes himself as a terrible golfer. What he really wanted to be was a jockey. So he said he talks about his family were felt other family members were more talented, but like animals was what during his school days he'd take horses out at the local riding school, and to him that this was the life. And it's just the way things fell for him. He obviously developed a talent, even as he says, I think it was David Fairty once described his swing as like an octopus falling out of a tree. So like he mentions that and said he never looked the part, but he just turned into, he practiced and fell into it and turned into this golfer who then would, you know, would play such a crucial part in 87 at the Ryder Cup. And so there's great detail about the old days, kind of driving around on a Honda 50, and you know he'd have a bell in the in the shop where he was working to alert him a customer, so he could basically spend his time close by just practicing all the time. So there's great detail about his whole background, his build up, how his life came to that point where he became this guy that played, was it the famous duel with Ben Crenshaw and the broken
putter,
club, yeah. Putter in the match. So it's just a wonderful detail in it, and it ties in present day with the slagging away from home. Obviously, what the Europe team are gonna face, and the shouts from the crowd about miss it, and he turns and kind of says, look to Ben, we'd be having a nice match if it weren't for these arseholes. So look, let's go. So like all the stuff that goes on inside the rope. So it's I must say it's a lovely piece, loads of great detail, really personal piece. So it's well worth a read.
That's in the Sunday Independent, Taria Al-Samari in the Irish Daily Mail on Sunday. How to win the Ryder Cup on foreign soil. It's only happened once in 20 years in Chicago when Europe won in 2012. Tony Jacklin was really the man who made Europe great when it came to Ryder Cups as a captain in the 80s. And he puts it, if you win, you're a genius. If you lose, you're a schmuck. Talking about the fact that, I quote here, having orchestrated Europe's win on British soil in 1985 and thereby the first US defeat since the success of the Great Britain and team in Yorkshire in 1957, Jacklin rallied against a land grab from the British PGA. They were seeking a greater share of the profits from an event that suddenly had renewed appeal and possibilities. The situation became so fraught that the British PGA's president, Lord Derby, a cousin of Queen Elizabeth, threatened to send a team of club pros to play in the 1987 match. This is the one Eamon Darcy was involved in. Over the likes of Ballesteros, Faldo, Langer and Sandy Lyle, Jacklin battled his way to a more sensible compromise, but does believe the episode probably cost me a knighthood. This is the kind of the intrigue that goes behind the Ryder Cup.
The Sunday Paper Review on Off the Ball.